It's January 1989, Rayford Prison, Florida. Death row. Bill Hagmeier, an FBI agent, walks quickly down the halls of Florida's state prison. He hurries down flights of stone steps, through the prison's winding tunnels, and past the bleak cells of men awaiting death. As the corridors grow darker, starved of any sunlight, Hagmeier comes to a stop outside of a white cage-like door. He pauses for a moment to catch his breath before asking the guard to unlock it. Hagmeier's been to this cell multiple times over the last 4 years. He's built an unlikely friendship with the man inside, a man who's regarded as one of the nation's most notorious serial killers. The man is facing death for 3 brutal murders and is suspected of more. Exactly how many more, no one knows. That's why Hagmeier's here today. With a prisoner's execution date looming, Hagmeier hopes he can finally get him to confess to the number of people he's killed. Hagmeier walks through the door and into the cell. As always, the sight fills him with disgust. On one side, a thin single bed is pressed against iron bars, and on the other, a gray metal chair is tucked beneath a small table. It's an awful place for someone to spend their final days, even if that someone is a convicted murderer. Sat in the middle of the cell, on the cold, hard floor, is the man Hagmeier's come to speak with today. The man whose name sends shivers through every single American. Ted Bundy. Bundy smiles when he sees Hagmeier and leaps up to greet him. His bright orange jumpsuit stands out against the dull gray walls of the prison. The two men shake hands and exchange pleasantries. Then, Hagmeier beckons Bundy to follow him from the cell and into a dark, sparsely furnished room just a few doors down. Once inside, both men sit across from each other, and Hagmeier reaches into his bag and pulls out a tape recorder. Staring into the piercing blue eyes of 42-year-old Bundy, Hagmeier starts to speak. He explains that everyone in America suspects Bundy of being one of the nation's most prolific serial killers. With his execution date just weeks away, time is running out to set the record straight. If Bundy doesn't confess now, no one will ever know the true extent of his crimes, and the murders he committed will remain unsolved. Bundy looks across at Hagmeier, a slight smile playing on his lips. Then he sighs deeply and lifts his shackled hands onto the table. In a friendly, conversational tone, he begins. I'm at the point finally where I can see that I'm going to have to tell you and others everything I know in regard to so-called unsolved cases. This is it. After 11 years of pleading innocent and denying all involvement in the crimes, Bundy is about to confess. Hagmeier shifts uncomfortably as he waits. He perhaps wonders, will Bundy identify each and every one of his victims? Is he about to reveal where he left their remains? And most intriguing of all, will Ted Bundy explain why he committed so many murders? At the moment of death, people often have an overwhelming need to get their biggest secret off their chest. From murder, fake identities, illicit affairs, and even government cover-ups, this show dives deep into the world's most explosive deathbed confessions. This is the story of Ted Bundy, America's most infamous serial killer. It's about a young boy who grew up to be a disturbed, dangerous adult, a man whose charm fooled everyone, and who dodged justice for 4 years. It's about the first televised murder trial in American history, the grotesque discoveries that were revealed, and a deathbed confession given days before Bundy's execution, which finally showed the true extent of his crimes. I'm Stephanie A. Hageman, and this is Deathbed Confessions.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all. But it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Between the years 1974 to 1978, Northwest America was plagued by a series of mysterious abductions and brutal murders. Young women disappeared at alarming rates from Washington State, Oregon, Utah, Vermont, Colorado, and Florida. Witnesses identified a man called Ted Bundy as the suspect, but there was no evidence directly linking him to any of the crimes. That was until late 1974, when a 19-year-old woman testified that Ted Bundy had tried to abduct and murder her. Bundy was found guilty of attempted kidnap in 1976 and sentenced to 1 to 15 years behind bars. While serving time, authorities in Colorado discovered evidence that linked Bundy to another felony, the first-degree murder of a 23-year-old woman. Their evidence was enough to charge him, and a trial date was set. But as the media frenzy grew around Bundy, it became clear that he wasn't an ordinary killer. He's intelligent, presentable, and charming. People couldn't help wondering if the police had the right man. And if they had, then what drove Bundy to attack and kill young women? How did he evade justice for so long? To answer these questions, we need to go to Vermont, 1946, where Ted Bundy was growing up. Theodore Robert Bundy is born in Burlington, Vermont on November 24, 1946. His mother, 21-year-old Louise, is unmarried, so she moves back to her parents' house in Philadelphia and raises Bundy with their help. For a time, Bundy is told that Louise is his older sister and that his grandparents are his real mother and father. It's not clear when exactly Bundy learns otherwise, but it must be known to him by 1951 when he's 5 years old, as Louise marries a man who becomes Bundy's stepfather. Bundy is taken away from his grandparents and moved over 2,000 miles west to his new home in Washington State. Bundy and Louise move into a modest house on South Sheridan Drive with Louise's new husband. The couple will go on to have 4 young children of their own. If the abrupt move from Philadelphia to Washington or the confusion of his parentage affect Bundy in any way, then he doesn't show it. He seems to lead a perfectly normal, happy life. Ted Bundy joins the Boy Scouts and goes on various adventures with his friends, learning how to shoot, make fires, and build camps. He attends church at least once a week with his family, who are strict Catholics, and performs well at school. However, there are several telltale signs that Bundy isn't quite like the other children. One time, when he's staying with his cousins, his aunt wakes up to find him standing at the foot of her bed. He's holding an array of sharp kitchen knives and is smiling as he watches her sleep. What's more, Bundy is somewhat socially isolated. Although his stepbrothers and stepfather try to include him as much as possible, he prefers his own company. Teachers remark to his parents that he struggles to understand social interactions and seems to feel little or no empathy for his classmates. They put it down to shyness, a trait they believe he'll grow out of. How wrong they'll be. As Ted Bundy grows from teenager to young adult, he continues to lead what looks like a normal life. He enrolls at the University of Washington in 1966 to major in Oriental Studies. At first, he performs well. He's liked by his professors, popular with friends, and in 1967, he even finds himself a girlfriend, fellow student Diane Edwards. Bundy and Diane's romance is powerful and passionate. They spend hours in each other's company, driving the long, wide roads of Washington, reminiscing about their past and dreaming of their future. But the relationship isn't without its faults. Bundy will later admit to feeling inadequate for Diane. He's convinced that she's the most beautiful, attractive girl out there, and he's paranoid she'll soon realize he's not good enough for her. Perhaps as a result of his incessant paranoia, Diane breaks their relationship off after a year. In the fall of 1968, she moves to California while Bundy is left in Washington. Heartbroken, he drops out of school and loses all momentum. His thoughts are constantly on Diane and how she abandoned him. In the years that follow, many will point to this breakup as a pivotal moment. The moment when something snapped inside of Ted Bundy. By the winter of 1968, it seems as though Bundy's found a new purpose in life. He moves west to Seattle and joins Republican Nelson Rockefeller's presidential campaign. Bundy also re-enrolls at the University of Washington and graduates with a degree in psychology in 1972. He plans to take the grueling law entry exams, the LSATs, in a year's time and apply to law school. Once again, it looks as though his life is on track for success. However, all is not as it seems. In the years following Bundy's graduation, while he stays in Washington with his new girlfriend Liz Klopfer and studies for his upcoming law exams, strange things start happening around him. In early 1974, 22-year-old Linda Ann Healy disappears from her house on the University of Washington campus. A little over a month later, a second student vanishes, followed by another five women between April and July. All women are later found to have been sexually assaulted and brutally murdered. Due to witness testimony, Bundy becomes the prime suspect in these murders and is charged with attempted kidnap in 1975. Incidentally, while living in Utah studying law, multiple other murders also take place. Police believe these to be the work of Bundy. Just 1 year after Bundy's kidnap conviction in 1976, a charge of first-degree murder is brought against him. The evidence is strong, and authorities believe they'll be able to lock Bundy up for life. But as the state prepares for his murder trial, no one realizes that the hardest part is yet to come. Bundy is unlike any individual America has ever known. As the sensational case builds, police quickly realize just how far out of their depth they really are. The date is now June 7th, 1977. At the Pitkin County Courthouse in Aspen, Colorado, the trial of 31-year-old Ted Bundy is underway. He's being charged with sexually assaulting and killing 23-year-old Karen Campbell in 1975. Bundy is pleading innocent, but the case against him is strong. Investigators found a ski map with Campbell's hotel circled, as well as an ice pick, crowbar, and a pair of handcuffs in Bundy's possession. Furthermore, they have proof that Bundy was staying near the Wildwood Inn, the hotel from where Campbell vanished. Coupled with his recent kidnapping conviction, it seems likely he'll be found guilty. Inside the courtroom, as the midday sunlight pours through the windows and the clock strikes one, the presiding judge calls for a recess. It's a warm afternoon and they've all been listening to evidence for hours. Everyone needs a break. Bundy is led out of the courtroom and taken up two flights of stairs to the library. Because of his background in law, he understands the legal proceedings well and is asked to do some of his own research in an attempt to help his case. So, two officers unlock the door to the library and usher Bundy through. They stand guard at the entrance and watch as he makes his way to the far end of the room. A tall shelf lined with hundreds of books stands next to a large closed window. Bundy peers out onto the sunlit town of Aspen before selecting a book and sitting down to read. 15 minutes pass in silence. The only sounds are those of Bundy slowly flicking through pages or the scraping of his chair as he stands up to look for a new book. Another 5 minutes pass and nothing happens. So, content that all is well, the officers turn their backs on the library and head outside to share a cigarette. However, 10 minutes later, when they return to tell Bundy that recess is over, they're met with a terrifying sight. Bundy is nowhere to be seen, and the window is wide open. Ted Bundy, a convicted kidnapper and suspected serial killer, is on the loose. At once, the small town of Aspen goes into a frenzy. Police cars speed off in all directions, looking for any signs of the elusive criminal. Roadblocks are put up at junctions, dogs follow Bundy's scent, and each car that passes through is thoroughly searched. Every effort is made to track Bundy and bring him back. Gradually, though, the sky begins to darken and the day draws to a close. Still, there's no sign of him. As police officers click on their flashlights and patrol the shadowy streets, their minds are filled with worry. Where could Ted Bundy be, and what atrocity is he committing? The days drag on and Bundy remains missing. The people of Aspen are on high alert, expecting to see Bundy's face round every corner, spot his infamous beetle crawling through the streets, or worse, hear the dreaded news that another girl has been taken. Then on June 13th, 6 days since he jumped from the window, Ted Bundy reappears. Officers find him driving a stolen car around Aspen. When they pull him over, Bundy is as charming as ever and shows no resistance as he's clamped in handcuffs and escorted to a new jail. Officers drive him 70 miles north to the Glenwood Springs Jail in Garfield County, a high-security prison. When he steps out of the car, Bundy smiles and laughs carelessly as journalists crowd round to snap his picture. When asked why he escaped and where to, Bundy replies that he'd simply grown bored of being cooped up inside all day and needed some fresh air. So he decided to jump from the window and make his way to the Aspen Mountains. Bundy explains this story so casually as though he's apologizing for being late to class, not for running away from a murder trial. His flippant response only adds to the intrigue around his case. America has never seen a criminal like this before.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
As he's locked into his new, secure cell, everyone in Colorado breathes a huge sigh of relief. They've been lucky. Bundy didn't commit a single abduction or murder in the 6 days he was away. But they should count their blessings while they can. Next time, they won't be so fortunate. It's now December 30th, 1977. Ted Bundy has been in the Glenwood Springs Jail for 6 months as his murder trial continues to play out across the nation. Unfortunately for Bundy, it seems likely that he'll be found guilty. The prosecution have recently shown the court fibers from Karen Campbell's body that belonged to Bundy's clothes. And witnesses from the Wildwood Inn have testified to seeing him hanging around the day Campbell disappeared. What's more, the public and press seem to be certain of Bundy's guilt. Despite outcries of protest from Bundy's mother and new girlfriend, Carol Ann Boone, disturbing stories about him are splashed across the headlines every day. And of course, his recent escape from the Aspen jail doesn't help his case. This morning, just like every other morning, police officers stroll down the familiar corridors of the prison to collect Bundy for another day of trial. When they reach his cell, they slot the key in the lock and twist the door open. It's dark inside and takes a few seconds for their eyes to adjust. Once they've grown used to the gloom, a strange emptiness greets them. Usually, Bundy would be up by now, dressed smartly, hair combed neatly to one side, making easy conversation with whoever. But there's no sign of him. Thinking how strange this is, one of the officers moves further into the cell and gestures to Bundy's bed. There's a mass underneath the covers. It appears as though Bundy is still asleep. The officer quickly peels back the bedsheets, ready to tell Bundy to hurry up. As he does so, a pile of pillows falls to the ground. The prison officers stare at each other in disbelief, mouths wide open and panic in their eyes. Surely it's not possible. It can't have happened again. But it's true. Ted Bundy has escaped. As December freezes to January, and America welcomes in the new year of 1978, police in Colorado feel little cause for celebration. Ted Bundy is still at large. There have been no sightings of him, no leads, and no telling what he's up to. It's an excruciating period of waiting, and all anyone can do is pray he'll be caught soon. Then, in the early hours of Sunday, January 15th, the news everyone's been dreading crackles onto the radio. Two young women have been found dead. The victims are 20-year-old Lisa Levy and 21-year-old Margaret Bowman. They were students at the University of Florida and were part of the Chi Omega sorority. The women were sexually assaulted and brutally killed as they lay sleeping in their sorority house. It's also revealed that the girls' two roommates and another friend were attacked as well. Fortunately, these three survived, but have been left with extensive injuries. As the tragic news travels across the country, no one's in any doubt as to who's behind the bloody attacks. Although they took place over 1,000 miles away from where Bundy was held in Colorado, it's certain that they're his work. The victim profile and MO are so typical of him, and it can't be a coincidence that while Bundy's been on the run, five more attacks have taken place. The search for Bundy moves east from Colorado to Florida. State police promise the terrified public that they'll find Bundy soon, before anyone else becomes a victim of his murderous appetite. January passes in a blur, and there's no sign of Bundy. He shoots straight to the top of the FBI's most wanted list, and police squads, governments, and investigators throw vast resources at the search. By now, Bundy's wanted in two separate states for three murders, as well as three counts of attempted murder and sexual assault. There's no denying the fact that he's one of the most dangerous men America has ever known. And no one has any idea where he could be. That is, until February 9th, 1978. Investigators in Florida are busy looking into the Chi Omega murders, compiling evidence that will be used against Bundy if he's ever found and taken to court. But their efforts are interrupted shortly before midday, when a local school phones with some disturbing news. A 12-year-old student called Kimberly Leach has gone missing. When police visit the school and press witnesses for details, they find out that Leach was last seen by fellow classmates during recess. Some claim she was talking to a strange man and left the premises with him. Police ask what the man looked like, but they already have their suspicions. As predicted, the stranger was tall, with curly hair and blue eyes. The stranger was Ted Bundy. Heartbreakingly, this means it's unlikely Kimberly Leach will ever be found alive. On February 15th, 1978, after 46 days on the run, Ted Bundy is finally arrested. While on a routine traffic stop in Pensacola, Florida, police notice a car driving with stolen license plates. When they pull it over and ask the driver to step out, it's 31-year-old Bundy. He's taken to the Pensacola County Jail and charged with two counts of murder and three counts of attempted murder. Although police believe he's responsible for the disappearance and presumed death of 12-year-old Kimberly Leach, a body hasn't been recovered yet, so it can't be treated as homicide. For the Chi Omega sorority murders, however, the evidence against Bundy is damning, and if he's found guilty, the sentences will be severe. All across America, people pray that he'll finally be brought to justice. The date is now June 25th, 1979. In Miami, Florida, it's day one of Ted Bundy's trial for the Chi Omega murders. He's pleading innocent, but if he's found guilty, he'll be put to death. The courtroom is packed. For the first time in American history, the murder trial is being televised. Journalists and reporters from every state in the U.S. are gathered in and around the courthouse. As a result, there's barely any room to stand. Spectators press their faces against windows, squeeze into corners at the back, and stand on tiptoes to get a glimpse of the man the nation has come to fear. Minutes before 9 a.m., the crowd watches as Ted Bundy strides out confidently, beaming at the jury, waving to the judge, and winking at his mother and girlfriend who sit nervously in the audience. He's dressed in a smart suit and bow tie, looking nothing like a prisoner. That's because today, Bundy is acting as his own attorney. He recently fired his court-appointed lawyers and filed a motion to defend himself. This bizarre and unprecedented decision will be the first of many strange things to take place throughout this case. As the trial unfolds, Bundy plays the part of a lawyer well. Performing to the cameras and crowds, he cracks jokes, shares stories, and smiles warmly around the courtroom. He seems determined to distract the jury from the murder charges at hand and brings forward numerous motions to divert their attention. Bundy files for a change of menu in the prison, increased exercise hours, more light in his room, a personal typewriter, and extended hours at the library. At first, Bundy's distractions seem to work. The jury laughs with him and laps up every word he speaks, and the judge even approves some of the motions. On one occasion, the judge leaves the courtroom and follows Bundy and guards to the cell to check the quality of light. When they return, the judge announces that he agrees with Bundy. The cell is too dark and needs to be improved. As the days turn into weeks, the nation watches Bundy's peculiar trial unfold. It's like nothing anyone's ever seen before. A man convicted of murder and suspected to be a serial killer is charming the entire courtroom and winning them over with his claims of innocence. No one knows what to make of it. Is it possible that the jury will be taken in by his magnetism and find him innocent? In mid-July, when Bundy's defense is finally over, it's the prosecution's turn to make their case. It's at this point when the tone of the entire trial changes. The evidence the prosecution has against Bundy is damning. First, they bring forward a witness who claims to have seen Bundy in the early hours of January 15, 1978, the day the Chi Omega murders took place. The student tells the court how she saw a tall man leaving the Chi Omega house in the early hours of the morning. In his hands, he was carrying a club. When asked if the man she saw is in the courtroom today, she answers, "Yes, he is," and points straight at Bundy. The next piece of evidence the prosecution brings forward is perhaps the most powerful of all. A forensic odontologist takes the stand and shows the jury a mold of Bundy's teeth. The jury leans forward, staring eagerly at the mold in front of them with a mixture of intrigue and confusion. The mold is a strange, unique shape. The front teeth are crooked, while the incisors are long and chipped. Once the forensic odontologist has satisfied the jury's seen enough, he pulls up a picture. It's an image taken of Lisa Levy's body, one of the two girls who was killed in the Chi Omega house. On Levy's body are two distinctive bite marks. The resemblance is uncanny. They match perfectly with the mold of Bundy's teeth. At this horrific realization, the atmosphere in the courtroom shifts drastically. There can be no denying it anymore. Bundy committed the Chi Omega murders. Surely nothing can save him now, not even his charm and smooth talking. On July 24th, 1978, after over 1 month in court, the trial of Ted Bundy comes to a close. The jury deliberates for just 6 hours before returning to file their verdict. they find Bundy guilty of all charges. He's indicted with 2 counts of burglary, 2 counts of first-degree murder, and 3 counts of attempted murder in the first degree. The jury recommend that he's put to death. As the jury's foreman reads out this verdict, hundreds of cameras focus on Bundy. They capture his startling reaction, how he smiles around the room and winks at his mother. It's as though he's promising her it'll be all right. Before ending the session, the judge calls Bundy forward and says he'd like to speak with him, in front of rolling cameras, hundreds of spectators, and numerous lawyers. The judge offers some surprising words of advice. He says, "Take care of yourself, young man. I say that to you sincerely. Take care of yourself, please. It is an utter tragedy for this court to see such a total waste of humanity as I've experienced in this courtroom. You're a bright young man. You'd have made a good lawyer, and I would have loved to have you practice in front of me. But you went another way, partner." And with that, Ted Bundy is led out of the courtroom, a death sentence hanging over his head. Unfortunately for Bundy, the criminal charges don't stop there. Just 4 months later, he's tried for the murder of 12-year-old Kimberly Leach. Tragically, her body was discovered 2 months after her disappearance. When Bundy's trial begins in November 1979, it's once again filled with drama. Bundy takes it upon himself once again to act as his own attorney and even cross-examines witnesses. In an unbelievable moment, he gets down on one knee in front of his girlfriend, Carol Ann Boone, and asks her to marry him. When she agrees, Bundy gleefully announces that this answer means they're now husband and wife. You see, under Florida jurisdiction, any proposal that takes place in front of a judge is the equivalent to a wedding ceremony. Despite this theatrical event, the members of the jury are not impressed. They listen to hours of testimony which proves that Bundy murdered Leach. Strands of her hair were found in his car, his clothing fibers were discovered on her body, and a school crossing guard saw him with Leach on the day she disappeared. On February 6, 1980, the jury finds Bundy guilty of first-degree murder. It comes with yet another sentence of death. As 33-year-old Ted Bundy is led away from the courtroom, the crowd focuses on him once again. This time, though, he doesn't smile or wink. Instead, he stares straight into the cameras in fury, shouting that he's innocent and that the jury have made a huge mistake. He vows to do everything he can to overturn their verdict. Despite the 2 death sentences now hanging over Bundy's head, not everyone is satisfied. He's been convicted of 3 homicides, just a fraction of what many suspect he's truly guilty of. There are still so many disappearances and murders that remain unsolved, cases which have haunted America since early 1974. Although police don't know exactly how many are linked to Bundy, they suspect almost 20 cases could be his work. Understandably, the families of these victims want answers. They deserve to see the person responsible punished. But so far, there isn't enough evidence to charge Bundy with any more murders. What's more, he continues to swear his innocence. In late 1979, when Bundy's sent to death row in Florida State Prison in Rayford, detectives, officers, and grieving families pray that he'll have a change of heart. Maybe with an execution date looming over him, he'll finally confess to the unsolved abductions and give everyone the closure they so desperately need.
This episode is brought to you by Rakuten. Are you ready to shop? Rakuten's Big Give Week is back. Get 15% cash back at hundreds of stores, including Headliners, Ulta, Ray-Ban, and Canon. Rakuten is how in-the-know shoppers get the best savings. They shop the brands they love and earn cash back on top of deals during Big Give Week, May 6th to May 13th. The cash back rates are even bigger. I'll be shopping for Adidas and Fenty. You can save on everything you need for summer, like clothing, outdoor gear, and travel. Join today for free and get an extra 10% cash back boost. That's an extra 10% cash back on top of Big Give Week's 15% cash back. You won't see higher cash back rates than these. Go to Rakuten.com or download the Rakuten app. R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Shoppers get it.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, considering his multiple escapes from jail and his theatrical murder trials, Ted Bundy's time on Rayford's death row is equally dramatic. In 1980, not long after he's sent down, Bundy gives a series of interviews to an American journalist. He recounts his entire life story, from his childhood in Vermont to his recent court cases. During the first few interviews, the journalist struggles to get Bundy to talk about the murders. Bundy seems intent on painting himself as a romantic hero, a tragic man who's been cruelly wronged. However, 6 months later, when the interviews are drawing to a close, the journalist asks Bundy to talk about the murders in the third person. He asks him to speculate what the killer may have done and why. Remarkably, this tactic works. Bundy grabs the tape recorder and speaks into it for hours, narrating chilling details about how he believes the murderer might have acted. At times, he's extraordinarily specific and says things about the killer, such as, "He parked his car down the street and then ran up behind the girl. Just as he came up on her, they were at a place where there was an orchard or a number of trees or something. As he came up behind her, she heard him. She turned around and he brandished a knife." There are several more revealing moments like these throughout the lengthy interviews. They're not quite murder confessions, as Bundy doesn't directly incriminate himself, but they're the closest anyone's gotten to hearing how his twisted mind works. Maybe these interviews will be the first step in getting him to admit to all of his crimes. Just 1 year after Bundy's insightful interviews, in 1981, he makes national headlines yet again. It's announced that Bundy's wife, Carol Ann Boone, has given birth to the couple's daughter. Apparently, Boone visited Bundy multiple times on death row, and guards made special exceptions for the newlyweds to spend some alone time, despite the fact that death row does not allow conjugal visits. Somehow, Bundy seems to be above the normal laws. This sentiment is echoed in July 1986, when Bundy obtains a stay of execution just 15 minutes before his scheduled death. A judge rules that he was not mentally competent to represent himself at trial, so due process wasn't served. Again, in November 1987, Bundy receives a second stay of execution 6 hours before he's meant to die. It appears to the world that the story of Ted Bundy will never end. Families torn apart by his murderous actions have to see his face on television, hear his voice on the radio, and read his name in newspapers. Yet still, in spite of this endless publicity, there's one question which remains unanswered. How many women did Bundy really kill? In January 1989, after almost 10 years on death row, the answer is revealed. When Bundy's third and final stay of execution is rejected and his date of death set for January 24th, Bundy makes a surprising confession to FBI agent Bill Hagmeier. He admits that he is guilty of the three murders he's been charged with, the murders of the two Chi Omega sorority women and 12-year-old Kimberly Leach. Not only this, he's also responsible for many more deaths. Bundy estimates that he's killed a total of 36 women. Over a series of recorded interviews with Hagmeier, Bundy goes into a frenzy of confessions. He admits that the FBI was right all along. The abductions and murders, which began in Washington 1974 and spread to Utah, Colorado, Vermont, Oregon, and Florida, were all his doing, as well as multiple other homicides. He goes on to reveal awful details about the women's deaths. He admits that he decapitated at least a dozen of his victims and kept their severed heads in his room for weeks. He also claims to have revisited certain corpses and sexually abused them before disposing of the bodies. The deathbed confessions of Ted Bundy are gruesome and heartbreaking. They prove that he's the most prolific serial killer in American history, one who spent years hiding in plain sight. Bundy himself knows this all too well. Before ending the interviews with Hackmeyer, he hauntingly admits, "We serial killers are your sons. We are your husbands. We are everywhere. And there will be more of your children dead tomorrow." While Ted Bundy's confessions answer many questions, mysteries still remain. You see, Bundy only gave sparse details on where the remains could be found. He refused to identify or name all of his victims. And when investigators follow his convoluted tips, they turn out to be wrong. Many believe that Bundy is deliberately withholding information in order to stretch out his time on Earth. But America has heard enough from Ted Bundy. For 15 years, the nation has been fooled by his charms and haunted by his crimes. Now, it's time for his execution. It's 7 a.m., January 24th, 1989. As the pale morning sun rises outside of the Florida State Prison, it casts light onto thousands of people below. Meters away from the gray walls of the prison, swarms of individuals are gathering on the grass outside. They're here for the execution of 42-year-old Ted Bundy. The atmosphere is one of celebration. Music blasts from speakers and radios. Fireworks burst into the sky. People hold colorful posters condemning Bundy to death, and cameramen snap photos of everything they see. There are even stalls set up to sell Bundy memorabilia, badges of the electric chair with Bundy strapped in, and t-shirts reading "Burn, Bundy, Burn." There's no question about it. The entire nation wants Bundy dead. At approximately 7:16 a.m., the double doors to the prison swing open, and a group of solemn-faced witnesses march out. At the sight of them, the awaiting crowd bursts into deafening applause, whistling, cheering, shouting, and crying with joy. The witnesses' presence can mean only one thing. Ted Bundy is dead. Ted Bundy is perhaps history's most infamous serial killer. Decades after his execution, his name instills chills, terror, as well as fascination. Bundy was a unique type of killer, one that America had never before seen. He was attractive, educated, and charming, and fooled society into believing he was a normal individual. When in fact, he was a serial killer hiding in plain sight. Tragically, we may never know the true extent of Bundy's awful crimes. Although he admitted to having killed 36 women on his deathbed, many believe this figure is an estimate. In reality, the total may be significantly higher. The only comfort the families of Bundy's victims can take is that he was eventually punished for his crimes, sent to his own death for the numerous lives he took away. America can only hope and pray that it will never see another individual as twisted, disturbed, and dangerous as Ted Bundy. Deathbed Confessions is a Spotify original from Parcast, produced in partnership with Noisver. Executive produced by Max Cutler, Drew Cole, and Pascal Hughes. Developed by Julian Boireau for Parcast. Series produced by Addison Nugent. Associate producer Nicole Edmonds. Written by Nicole Edmonds. Supervising editor Jane O. Sound supervisor Tom Pink. Sound design by Cody Reynolds Shaw. Edited by Carla Flores and Rob Plummer. Mix master by Cody Reynolds Shaw. Music by Oliver Baines and Dory McCauley.